Welcome, folks, to the Food Pod for Humanity. We are thrilled to bring you a second series of your favorite podcast looking at food systems and climate change. This season, we are examining various aspects of and perspectives on plant-based diets and alternative proteins. Could they be just the solution needed to transform our food systems locally and at the global scale? This is Joshua Luija from the Food for Humanity team at the Columbia Climate School, part of Columbia University in New York City. In our first episode of this series, we welcome two powerhouse guests to outline the current state of agriculture, particularly the raising of animals for consumption. We want to start off by examining the why. Or in other words, let's attempt to define the problems we are facing with regard to animal agriculture and identify what needs to change. In the food system space, it comes up a lot about how much better vegetarian and vegan options can be for both the planet and our health. But why is animal farming so bad for the environment and for people? Why should we cut down on meat and animal products? Why should we work on changing our diets and habits? The why is the starting point for us to begin to change. Examining the context of the problem is important for contemplating and applying the solutions. Let's kick this off. Our first guest is Mario Herrero Acosta from Cornell University, who began his career in sustainable food systems at the farming level. Mario is a regular contributor to important global initiatives at the heart of food, nutrition, and environment, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Lancet Commission on Obesity, and the Eat Lancet Commission on Healthy Diets from Sustainable Food Systems. He has worked extensively in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Mario is the perfect guest to help us understand the state of agriculture and animal agriculture today within our global and local food systems. What are the benefits and impacts?
Hi, everyone. My name is Mario Herrero. I'm a professor of food systems and global change here at Cornell University. I got into food originally working on a farm, actually. I started working on a farm in the tropics in my country, Costa Rica. One of the things that I noticed was that there was nature all around. You had the farm, I used dairy cows, but also, you know, there were toucans, there were a lot of wild animals. I got interested in farming while at the same time protecting nature. That took me to study agriculture and then livestock and sustainability. I did my PhD in ecology. As a result, I've been since then, this is in the early 90s, combining my knowledge on the environment with how to actually produce and consume more sustainably. The state of animal agriculture, well, the key feature is that it's a very large sector. It's a sector with a total value higher than the crop sector. It's a sector that uses a significant amount of land. 80% of the global agricultural land is used for animals. It produces a lot of highly nutritious food, and it employs people, and it gives livelihoods to farmers, to many women, especially in low and middle income countries. It employs about 1 billion people in large value chains. It contributes to about 40% of agricultural GDP, and it's growing. It's growing simply because there's a very large demand for animal source foods. The richer the people get, the more urbanized, the more they want to consume meats. But in the process of doing so, well, it generates a significant environmental footprint. We're talking about around 15% of global greenhouse gases. It uses about 70% of the water. It also is a major disruptor of nitrogen and phosphorus cycles. Why? Because it generates a lot of manure. It's sometimes great if you're a smallholder farmer and you can use it for your crops. But as systems get more industrialized, there's really large piles of manure that need to be treated appropriately so that they don't become sources of pollution to our water sources. There are many, many different kinds of production systems. So on one hand, you have grassland-based systems, you have feedlots, you have systems of different levels of intensities. There is definitely big equity issues in the food system. And not only at the producer level, but throughout, there's many winners and losers, and there's many vulnerable people that don't really have access simply because, you know, they're disenfranchised.
Thanks, Mario, for helping us see this bigger picture of animal agriculture within our global food system, the benefits and values animal agriculture provides, as well as the impact it has on our ecosystems and climate. As he stated, there are different types of agriculture systems that impact in different ways. Farmers within these various systems also have various farming practices, management options, access to resources, information, and opportunities. In our last series, we discussed the immense greenhouse gas emissions produced by agriculture and land use. Let's dig a little bit deeper into the emissions and energy and resource efficiency of cattle farming and livestock keeping. We chatted with environmental scientist Matthew Hayek to better understand how we measure and account for impacts of different types of farming systems and practices, especially when we're estimating impacts for the vast, complex global food system. Matt was recently named as one of Vox's 2024 Future Perfect 50 innovators, thinkers, and changemakers working to make the future a better place. So let's hear from Matt about how he began to look into the impacts of raising cattle on our ecosystems, starting with the Amazonian rainforest.
I'm Matthew Hayek. I'm a professor in the Department of Environmental Studies at New York University. I have a PhD in environmental science, where I would measure greenhouse gases in the Amazon rainforest to try to understand its responses to climate change. I then pivoted towards food systems because of how much the expansion of beef and soy was actually destroying the Amazon rainforest, and I got to see some of that destruction firsthand. It made that motivation feel very urgent in me. And so now I quantify greenhouse gas emissions and land use change from global food production. In the Amazon rainforest, it was really the expansion of those food commodities. Those are very important commodities because both end up kind of fueling animal agriculture. Almost all beef production in the Amazon, by the way, is entirely or almost entirely grass-fed. And even that was having really devastational effects because of the sheer land use requirements. It takes more land area to produce a ton of beef or a gram of protein from beef than protein from any other commodity that we grow. 1/4 to 1/3 of all greenhouse gas emissions on Earth come from the food system, animal agriculture representing around 12 to 20%.
Hey, this is Danny Din from the Food for Humanity Initiative team. I'm also your co-host for this podcast series on plant-based and alternative proteins. Speaking of greenhouse gas emissions, let's recap a bit. There are three main types of greenhouse gases that we are releasing into the atmosphere through our food system activities: carbon dioxide, CO2, methane, CH4, and nitrous oxide, N2O. Carbon dioxide is the most abundant and long-lasting, but methane and nitrous oxide, although short-lived, are many times more potent in warming our atmosphere. The net sources of CO2 comes from all the fossil fuels that we use to produce and transport food, fuel the farming equipment, processing machinery, shipping, refrigeration, and so on. An even bigger source of CO2 comes from deforestation, when we cut down and convert native forests into agricultural land. Deforestation is happening at devastating fast rates around the world, especially in the tropics. Forests, are natural CO2 storage, because the CO2 that plants absorb to photosynthesize are stored in the plants themselves in the soil. Cutting down forests release carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. If the vegetation then burn off or flooded, that also leads to methane being released due to fermentation and decomposition. When we use fertilizers to enhance the growth of crops and animal feeds, nitrous oxide emissions also get released into the atmosphere. But a large amount of methane comes from raising cattle for human consumption. So let's get back to Matt for a moment to learn how cattle farming emissions are modeled. How do these different ways of raising cattle that we see on food packages, like free-range, grass-fed, or grain-fed, all compare in terms of emissions?
This is exactly the question that I and my colleague Rachel Garrett wanted to ask. And so we actually created a scenario based on USDA data of, you know, how quickly cattle fatten up in feedlots where they're fed corn and soy and alfalfa versus how quickly they fatten up when they're eating predominantly grass on pasture. We modeled a scenario where cattle who are currently being fattened up at the end of their lives, or quote unquote finished in intensive grain feedlots, instead are finished or fattened up only on grass. And those results are really important because we found that to move away from feedlots and towards an exclusively grass-fed system in the United States, we would need 30% more cattle just to do that, because those cattle fatten up more slowly and reach lower overall slaughter weights to produce the same amount of beef that Americans are currently consuming. What we then found was that those cattle would be belching even more methane than cattle in the United States currently do, which accounts for something like 3% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. That amount of methane would increase to 43% higher than they're already belching if we moved them to exclusively grass-fed diets, which brings the question about why was the soy so destructive? Is it the tofu and the soy protein isolate that a lot of first world consumers are consuming? Well, barely any of that, 4 to maybe even just 1% of the soy grown in the Amazon is going to those soy consumer goods. The vast majority of it is being turned into animal feed and cooking oil. Every soybean, you extract 20 or 30% cooking oil from it, and the rest, 70 or 80%, goes as feed to animal agriculture, predominantly chickens and pigs in high-income countries, as well as some intensive beef feedlots where they fatten up cattle at the very end of their lives. We can also talk about manure and local air pollution and all these other things. But when it comes to climate emissions, the answer is that grass-fed cattle emit more. Their lives are longer, so they have longer to be belching that methane. The second is that cattle can digest grass and we can't, because they're fermenting all of that rough fiber, that cellulose, in their rumen chambers using bacteria and archaea, microbes, that produce methane as a byproduct. When they eat corn and soy, they're just consuming those nutrients directly and fattening up directly on the carbohydrate and protein and fat that those nutrients contain. But when they eat grass, they have to perform that microbial fermentation, and methane is the byproduct. This result was really counterintuitive for many, but it really goes to show that if you want to eat quote-unquote better beef, higher welfare, more free range, more like their natural life cycles, it's going to actually require us to reduce even more of that consumption, because that beef has even higher greenhouse gas emissions per, you know, ounce of steak. The middle of the road business as usual scenario for the rising amount of meat and dairy predominantly in middle income countries and consistently high amounts in high income countries, that scenario by the year 2050 alone will definitely take us past 1.5 degrees of warming and possibly up to 2 degrees of warming, even if we were to cease emitting fossil fuels, burning and emitting fossil fuels yesterday. So food systems alone can take us past these dangerous thresholds of global warming. And by food systems, again, I mean predominantly beef and dairy consumption, as well as a fair amount of monogastric, like pig and chicken meat consumption. And it is to a lesser extent, that pig and chicken meat consumption because of the amount of grains and oil seeds like soy that we need to produce and expand croplands and deforest rainforest and other ecosystem in order to meet that rising demand.
So there you have it, folks. Most of the cultivation of soybeans that are fueling the destruction of the Amazon are in fact for animal feed, to raise cows and produce beef for human consumption. The soybeans grown for the tofu we eat are innocent. That pushes back on those arguments that contend that plant-based, especially soy-based protein products are just as unsustainable as meat products. But certainly, researchers will continue studying and trying to find the answers to these questions. In the meantime, let's raise another question. How much should we rely on the modeled results as a motivation to change our diets and consumption habits?
The models are very well understood to be robust and well account for all of the emissions. When we talk about the models and our confidence in it, there's lots of things we do, and generally we're kind of adding and multiplying these terms from like the bottom up. How many cows are there? What's the average amount they belch in this continent versus that continent? Which does introduce some uncertainty, but those uncertainties are on the order of 25, 30, maybe 50%, which means even if the real error bounds aren't just 12 to 20%, like I said, I would argue they're probably something more in the, you know, realm of 5 to 40%, right? That is still a large amount of greenhouse gas emissions, even if we aren't totally certain to decimal points of precision. Anything more than 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions needs tackling in order to bring us under those crucial warming limits that we're trying to hit.
At this point, if you're as concerned as I am about our food-related greenhouse gas emissions, you're probably wondering if everything we eat is equally bad for the environment. Matthew helped us clear up the difference in impact between soybeans grown for human consumptions versus soybeans grown for cattle feed. But in general, how do we as consumers navigate between the different types of products, plant-based or animal-based? What are the best practices in terms of consuming ethically and sustainably?
The global food system is so huge, and there is a lot of regional variation in terms of the environmental impacts of growing a commodity in one place versus another. Something that I want to make very clear, though, is that there is almost no zero impact food in our food system, especially if you bought that food in a grocery store or even a farmer's market. Growing food has an environmental impact anywhere, even if it's from your farmer's market, even if it's organic and local, because you have to displace native ecosystems to grow food. There is no way around that. So, you know, it is still the case that you can grow soy or corn in one place versus another, and one place would have five times fewer or five times more impact in one place than another. You can grow beef in a, you know, native grassland in a country with a high production efficiency, like somewhere in the Western United States, versus growing beef in a recently deforested tropical region with very low production efficiency and have four or five times the environmental impact in the latter than the former. That being said, I think it's very easy to underestimate the amount of resources that growing animals for human consumption requires, because all of those animals need to eat. So when you eat meat, that food needed to be fed food. And those feed baskets, as we call them, come from all over the region and the earth. So even if I were to eat local pork grown in Warwick County, just, you know, a little further upstate, up the river, that pig needed to have eaten grain that grows from the Midwest or somewhere from California or even another country. It is important to support our local food sheds, our local economies. I think it's important to try talking with producers who are trying to produce their food a little differently. It's just important that we don't give into kind of magical thinking that some, you know, net positive or net regenerative food magically exists. To farm is to interrupt cycles of nature for human consumption.
Matt made a really important point about talking to your food growers and producers. Our food environment in the U.S. tends to remove and isolate consumers from the people who grow, harvest, transport, prepare, package, and sometimes even those who cook our food. We sit in restaurants with the kitchen out of view. We pick up ready-to-eat or heat-and-serve products from the supermarket. We buy fruits and vegetables that someone harvested in another country or even continent. Overall, we are fairly removed from so much of the food supply chain. Farmers, especially farmers that work on a small scale in non-industrialized settings, can also report feeling removed from the market and the consumers who eat the food they grow. We asked Mario to help us better understand the kinds of uncertainties that might still remain if we were to rapidly shift to a plant-based diet globally. We also asked what kinds of opportunities exist to empower less resource consumers and those smallholder farmers to lead food system transformations where they are to be more sustainable and less dependent on meat production.
And there has to be space within an equitable food system to really develop safety nets, to really actually repurpose subsidies so that they can actually target poor consumers. And there has to be incentives for smaller farmers and for medium-sized farms to actually produce food. This doesn't need to be just corporation running the show. No, I think that there's many agents here that we would need to prioritize. Even if in a market-oriented economy, there's ways of doing that. There's plenty of options for managing better livestock systems, for increasing productivity. One fundamental observation is that we really need to try to reduce animal numbers. And this is particularly easier for the dairy sector. You need to have less but more productive cows. And this is a lesson that applies to places like sub-Saharan Africa, where, you know, most of the growth in production is due to increases in animal numbers. But this would actually make farmers get the same or more income, but they will be able to be kinder to the environment and put less pressure on resources. There's 680 million smallholder farmers. They actually are an engine of change, and food systems transformation is occurring in many parts. We've been connecting smallholders to markets, and that's been incredibly important so that they become more market-oriented. We've improved food environments and informal food markets, improving food safety. They're much better equipped now. There's a series of solutions that they're already implementing that have shown tremendous success. Smallholder dairy is one of the really big examples of success where, you know, by increasing milk production, having less but more productive cows, farmers have had way more disposable income than to buy other things and improve their food baskets. And at the same time, they've improved their kids' nutrition in the house. So it's those kinds of things that I see really becoming success stories that are scalable. At the same time, they are also custodians of important tracts of land. When we really start paying them for all the benefits that those farms can provide, a lot of the ecosystem services, that would be another important source of diversification.
In recent years, especially if you're in the U.S. and interested in the type of topics covered in this podcast, you may have started to hear the term regenerative agriculture increasingly. For pop culture aficionados, I ran across an Instagram hashtag ad posted by a fairly well-known actor touting the regenerative agricultural practices being implemented by McCain Foods Global. You know, the ones responsible for 1 in 4 French fries around the world. So it definitely seems like the concept is making its way from scientific and farming circles into the zeitgeist. Regenerative agriculture is an approach to agriculture employing farming and management practices that aim to bring more benefits and make our agricultural and food systems more sustainable. Proponents of it claim that the intense and concentrated impacts of animal agriculture can be mitigated or offset through better soil management and other holistic agricultural management practices. This sounds pretty great, but is this a feasible solution to help transform our agri-food systems at scale and around the world? We asked both Mario and Matt to weigh in.
Oh, there's no one solutions. There's no silver bullets in all of this. I'm all in favor of regeneration. And why? Because livestock farmers are custodians of vast tracts of land in the world. And ultimately, if they take into account the multifunctionality of their landscapes, of which one of the objectives would be to produce animal protein, but also if they cared about, you know, all the other ecosystem services that would benefit different parts of those landscapes, and they were paid for them, for those services, then we would actually have a very diversified system that will meet health, nutrition, and environmental objectives at the same time. And this is what regenerative agriculture offers. Imagine not having a monoculture or just not having a paddock full of dairy cows, but then having trees sequestering carbon, having pollinator services, ensuring that nitrogen doesn't end up in the creeks, and so on. We have real potential to do this, and especially in livestock farms that are of way lower intensity than in the croplands.
Matt also provided some crucial context for discerning the net benefits of regenerative agriculture.
There are some principles of regenerative agriculture that would represent a major benefit compared to how we're raising food today, and that's because how we're raising food today is so deleterious for the natural environment. So when we say regenerative, it's important to account regenerative compared to what? Regenerative compared to massive rates of erosion and synthetic inputs and greenhouse gas emissions? Sure, we can do better than that. We can make it relatively more regenerative, add a little bit of that topsoil back, take, you know, some of the least efficient and most toxic synthetic inputs out of that production. But to do a fully organic, quote unquote, regenerative system would require much, much lower yields per acre. I mean, we're talking in some cases 50% or even less yield in a given acre, which means that if we wanted to completely abandon synthetic inputs, abandon animal feeds and only graze cattle on grass, things along these lines, we would need much, much more land than the one third of the earth that we are already farming and grazing animals on, which is not sustainable, right? It might look sustainable, very sustainable on that acre, but you have to account for the fact that that food system would require many, many more acres, as well as more human labor and a number of other things that can be quite unrealistic for the food system. So again, it's really about taking that wider scope.
In this last portion of this episode, we want to bring it back to our personal responsibility. Having learned about the environmental impacts of raising and consuming meat and animal-based products, and the urgent need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to curb climate change, what can you or I, as individual consumers, do? How can we navigate the landscape of so many products and claims? How can we make the best choices when shopping and choosing what to consume? Matt offered what he called three organizing principles that I think are quite helpful.
It is a very confusing landscape for consumers to navigate. We have so many different labels on products now attesting to environmental claims. It used to be the fact that we had a confusing amount of labels for nutrition. It's like cholesterol-free cereal. Well, what does that even mean? Does cereal even normally have cholesterol? No, it doesn't. So, and now we're getting to a very similar thing with our food products. We have grass-fed beef labels. We have organic and now even regenerative labels. We have locally produced labels. The best label is still the ingredients label. And the largest impact that the average meat-eating consumer can make is to reduce that meat consumption by a little or a lot. If you already consume 1/6 of the meat of the average American, that is instead of 220 pounds a year, you know, something on the order of 60 pounds a year of all meat combined, then you're actually doing pretty well. And that would be something like 3 or 6 ounce serving of meat every other day, rather than eating meat at every meal. Multiple studies have come out, one from Joseph Poor and Thomas Nemechek, another more recent one, showing that while there is vast difference in terms of how efficiently and sustainably different foods are produced within the same commodity for a given ingredient produced in different regions on Earth and in the country, the biggest difference that you can make is consuming less meat. Another way of putting that is that even the most efficient meat production is still less sustainable than some of the least efficient plant ingredient production. The biggest impact that you can have, the biggest positive impact that you can have, is reducing excessive meat consumption. You can go beyond that and think about not just what is most environmentally sustainable, but what's socially sustainable and what's better for the animals themselves. And it may be the fact that you do want to purchase some meat, you know, from your upstate entirely grass-fed producer at your farmer's market. As I mentioned, though, that beef actually has a higher greenhouse gas footprint than the commodity steak you got from the supermarket. Even though that's very counterintuitive, it really is the case. So we could do better by consuming, quote unquote, better meat, but that entails reducing even more of it. Less and better meat means even less meat. That's the second kind of organizing principle. And the third, I would say, is just become a little bit more aware of how all those ingredients are produced. Don't listen to influencers, though. Talk to farmers at your farmer's market. Talk to some commodity producers. There are really good interviews online with people producing wheat and peas and corn and kind of what goes into that. Just try to get a little bit more awareness from farming and scientific sources about how food is produced, not from Instagram or social media or TikTok or social media influencers. And that would probably be my third principle.
Podcasters are fine though, right?
evidence-based podcasters are great. I can't necessarily say that most podcasters out there right now are taking a strictly evidence-based approach.
Fair enough, yes.
Mario also offers a practical approach to making the most healthy and sustainable food choices within our limited budget and constrained options.
I really think that we cannot expect companies or governments to really act on our behalf. I want to have, you know, accountable consumers as well. The consumer is part of the solution, and our individual choices will matter more and more. As consumers, we really need to try to eat as well as possible within our budget. And this actually means trying to source products with low levels of processing, try to eat as fresh as possible, all the vegetables and the fruits, if we can get them. That's probably one food group that none of us eats enough of. In terms of animal products, provenance also matters a lot. If you can get food from high welfare, less industrialized systems, less hormones, etc., that would be a better choice. But of course, I can understand that price is a big issue for people. So you buy what you can. And if you ask me, what would I eat less of? It's all discretionary foods, aka junk. That would be where I would start. You start by reducing junk food consumption, increase fruit and veg and whole grains, consume animal proteins in moderation, consume more legumes and things like that. You know, it's not that difficult to start making the change. Start with a lunch. You might be used to having your typical ham and cheese sandwich. Well, why not make it, you know, a roasted vegetables or something like that? It might be one meal, but if all of us did that one meal, and then started to incorporate these kinds of slightly different consumption behaviors, you know, we will start making important changes.
Just eat more fruits and veggies. The good old doctor advice still stands as the best for our bodies and our planet. But we did tell you early on that our topic for this podcast series also includes on-the-market and up-and-coming alternative proteins. So we expect that our listeners would be very curious to learn more about these products. At the moment, there are three categories of plant-based and alternative protein products. The first type is just simple, straightforward food products made from plants that you can often find in your local grocery store and likely have eaten many times, like black bean burger patties, soy nuggets, coconut cream, almond milk, oat milk. The second type of food products involve a process called precision fermentation, which uses microorganisms like yeast and other microbes to produce plant-based proteins that offer better taste and desirable properties. The best examples of this category are nutritional supplement powder for protein shakes, or non-dairy cheese that stretches and melts, or plant-based hemoglobin that makes the Impossible or Beyond Burger Patty more flavorful and juicy. The third type of products involve lab-based cell cultivation, in which whole animal cells are replicated rather than just the individual proteins. And because they are an entirely new food category and technology, cell-cultivated meat companies only just receive U.S. federal safety inspections and approvals to sell to consumers in 2023. These products are still very rare, very expensive to make, and are not yet readily available to the average consumers like you and I. We ask Mario how this landscape of alternative proteins will continue to evolve.
You know, alternative proteins, we don't have them at a scale where we can actually really quantify the tangible benefits. We've done modeling studies, yes, of what would it be if we actually replaced significant proportion of animal protein. And yes, the results are positive from an environmental perspective. They're a little bit neutral from an employment perspective. But, you know, we still don't know really too much about the behavior of consumers. Are these really proteins that will replace animal source foods, or will they be just an additional choice that consumers eat maybe on a Monday or something like that? If it's extra choice, the benefits will be a lot lower. And then, you know, the other thing is, what do we mean by alternative proteins? Do I really need to go for something that is ultra processed and with a lot of packaging, etc.? Or should I eat a plate of lentils? Or should I eat tofu, which is an alternative protein that has been with us for centuries and centuries? There's options, some more natural than others, some with more benefits than others. How this universe of products will actually evolve and which will be the winners and losers, we don't know clearly what will happen.
Mario referred to this degree of uncertainty regarding consumer reception to alternative proteins. There's no shortage of research attention on this topic right now. A paper by Akinmei et al., 2024, examined the factors that influence consumer attitudes towards alternative proteins. And the short answer is, well, it really depends. Indeed, consumer behavior is complex and influenced by many factors that are personal, societal, or something specific about the product itself. Even within the same country, significant differences may exist among distinct groups of consumers, and even more nuances may exist within each group, so it cannot be generalized. This highlights the need for more cross-cultural and context-specific consumer research. When it comes to food, cultural and social representation matter, not just whether a plant-based option is being offered. One of our interview guests in the next episode will touch more on this. A number of interesting studies are being conducted right now by researchers at Stanford University. One study, cheekily titled Traditional and Contemporary Meat Options Study, or TACOS, is testing how the presence and type of plant-based meat alternatives on restaurant menus affect consumers' purchases of different meats. They are testing this by using three hypothetical but realistic Chipotle menus with varying plant-based meat options. Another study is analyzing the effects of plant-based meat alternatives in restaurants using sales data from 30 restaurants that have recently introduced plant-based meat alternatives to their menus. Researchers hope to see whether and to what extent introducing plant-based meat alternatives may change the meat consumption pattern. There is also a collaborative research initiative that is creating a global network of campus dining halls at colleges and universities. These dining halls can essentially serve as laboratories for behavior change, where researchers can launch pilot studies and experiments. Here's another question that we can answer with more certainty. How do environmental impacts of plant-based protein, alternative protein, and animal-based protein products compare to each other? Which one is really the best? Longtime vegan and aspiring chef Matthew Hayek is here with some guidance.
My colleague and I, Jan Dutkowitz, we wrote an article for Vox looking at plant-based because that is what's available widely. And what we found is when it came to animal-based meats and plant-based meat analogs, that plant meat analogs beat out animal meats almost every time. There were some exceptions where plant-based burger had a few more emissions than a highly efficiently raised chicken. But for the most part, they were in two separate camps entirely in terms of their greenhouse gas emissions. While there are some differences, a more traditional, you know, like a veggie burger from 20 years ago, like a Boca or Morningstar farm probably does have fewer emissions, I think because it doesn't have as many fat products that tend to come from slightly higher emission sources, is more sustainable than a next generation, the things that we hear about, like the Beyond, Impossible, et cetera. People also don't like those products as much. A ground meat substitute is never going to be broccoli. There's an increasing amount of evidence that the way that these even very fatty, juicy burgers are reformulating themselves to become marginally healthier is still beating out 80-20 ground beef in randomized control trials in terms of the indicators of health that we really look to, like blood cholesterol, like ApoB, like these, you know, these important nutritional biomarkers. And now there's more evidence from longitudinal cohort studies as well that meat analogs as a whole tend to perform better, especially than processed meats, which we know are associated with coronary heart disease and certain cancer risks. So I will say that the best plant-based meat product to try is the one that tastes best to you and you can imagine eating over and over again, or at least eating for the next few months. Because I think that an important role for these products that we often miss and that we lose sight of when we talk about the exact, you know, saturated fat or salt content is that these alternative proteins can be a very important, you know, like gateway drug. But I think gateway foods do exist, things that can begin to open a door for people. Beans, for instance, are even more sustainable than these plant-based meat products, but they are very hard to cook. And when people try to, especially from dried, I think they're quite easy to take out of a can, but they're still difficult to make taste delicious because you need to add a lot of base ingredients like aromatics, like garlic and onion and tomatoes and celery and carrot and get a good base going and make them taste really savory and umami, which is the flavor profile that we normally get from meat. That takes effort. That takes time. And, you know, maybe it's the case that you go to a shortcut and look for a plant-based meat product that you really like while you slowly over time get those beans to taste as delicious as like they often do in Latin American countries or Tuscany or somewhere else where beans are a very regular, sustainable, and healthy part of the diet. I think the high-tech solutions are worth investing in, but I think a really important part of the climate equation is that this problem is so urgent that we need to rapidly scale up the technologies that we have today, from renewable energy to electric vehicles, to better walkable cities and more urban transit, to heat pumps in the home, to plant-based diets and plant-based meat analogs. Then there's going to be an additional part of those emissions that are going to take longer to decarbonize, like construction equipment, like airplanes, and like the stakes that people still don't want to give up, even though we have some next generation of mock ground meat. And that's where research and development comes into play. And that's where we should be putting a good portion of our climate dollars still to think how we're going to decarbonize that long tail of the remaining 20% of stubborn emissions throughout the next century.
Well, if you have stuck with us thus far, you deserve a little treat. We got Matt to share the secret to cooking the notoriously challenging beans and giving them that umami flavor. And if you're based in New York City, we've got some plant-based food recs to share.
So, I mean, the first thing that I'll say about beans is I got better cooking beans when I was doing research in the Brazilian Amazon and I watched the Brazilian cooks at the field site prep them. And the main thing was that they did not shy away from using more fat and salt and aromatics like garlic and onions. And when you're cutting meat out of the diet, you can be not afraid of using a little extra fat because there's so much that is sneakily in your meat and dairy. The number one and two sources of cholesterol, for instance, in the American diet are eggs and chicken skin. And when you cut out some of these ingredients, you don't necessarily realize how much fat you're taking out of your diet. And that can lead to decreased satiety, that can lead to less flavor. So don't be afraid to be more generous with that olive oil and build up your flavor base. Use savory things like garlic, onion, mushroom, tomato, the real sources of umami or protein flavor, hearty protein flavor in the diet. You can also look to ingredients like miso and soy sauce, as long as you're not going totally overboard on the salt content with that. And most of the salt that we eat is also in prepackaged foods. So if you're learning to cook at home, don't be afraid to salt generously until you like the taste. Then once you start getting used to the taste of beans, fresh vegetables from the supermarket or farmer's market, incorporating a lot more fruit, you can eventually take some of the salt and sugar and fat out of the diet as your palate adjusts. But just don't be afraid of some of these quote unquote unhealthy ingredients, because if you're cooking at home, it's automatically going to be healthier than what you're eating out or what you're getting prepackaged. Almost always automatically healthier. Try to get the best of the both worlds by shouting out to my friend Chloe Coscarelli, who runs Chloe on Bleecker here, which is just a wonderful kind of neighborhood community spot with a big family table in the middle. And it has everything from fresh salads to delicious plant-based cookies and cupcakes, which is just insane. I mean, her claim to fame was like 10 years ago going on the Food Network show Cupcake Wars and without using any dairy or eggs, beating out like three other trained pastry chefs with the best cupcake. The reason that I mention that for people outside of New York is I think some of her cookbooks are the best there is in terms of the consistency of how well they turn out, even when a total novice makes them.
Thanks, Matt. For me, the hardest part of giving up meat is finding the meatless version of the delicious and comforting Vietnamese food that I grew up eating, the things that my mom used to make. It's a bit harder in New York than in Vietnam or areas of large Viet enclaves like Southern California or Houston. So I really want to shout out my love for San Saigon, a tiny vegan Viet cafe in Lower Manhattan, where you can find a rotating menu of various broth noodles, spring rolls, banh mi, and vermicelli bowls. For more food so delicious you forget they're plant-based and is still cheap enough to eat often, go get some vegan dim sum at the original Buddha Bodai on Mott Street in Chinatown.
Though I'm not currently vegan or vegetarian, I flirted with it in the past, and I'm always looking for ways to make delicious plant-based foods at home. Better for the environment, but also good for my health and my wallet too. I have a picky 8-year-old at home, so it has to meet his tough standards too. I am most consistently successful when I cook warm, comforting meals he's used to, but just leave out the meat. Rice and beans are a go-to weekday dinner in my Caribbean house, but so are soups with lots of slurpy noodles or soft, pillowy dumplings, rich salty broth, and a few sneaky vegetables. Tortellini and brodo is an Italian classic that I make often, with a vegetable-based broth, a few handfuls of spinach, and a mushroom or spinach-based tortellini. Store-bought is fine. And I have to echo what Matt said about not being afraid to season. Even a simple salad can be taken to another flavor level with some fresh ground pepper or some red pepper flakes. The key message that we keep hearing from our first two guests of the season is that less meat is better. People can be enticed to make small changes, and they'll all add up to larger shifts. Next episode, we'll hear from the Mayor's Office of Food Policy, who will tell us more about the types of small behavioral changes that can be encouraged to produce those bigger shifts. We'll also hear from a public health and nutrition expert about the global trends in nutrition, diets, and policies to promote healthier and more sustainable diets. This has been the Food Pod for Humanity, produced and edited by Joshua Luisa and Danny Din for the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Columbia Climate School. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Matthew Hayek and Dr. Mario Herrero Acosta, for their insights, and to music producer Pablo Martin for providing the mix you're grooving to this season. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you're listening right now to get the latest episodes on your feed. If you have any questions about what we discussed or suggestions for future podcast topics, let us know at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu. Until next time.